a very strange feeling about the entire counseling of young men. Quite frankly, we're talking about boys in many cases that he was doing, and who knows what else we may learn about this in the future. That's about it. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a very disturbing COVID conspiracy theorist who called in. Listen to this.
Yo, Pax, what up, man? Total Control 871. Yo, what's up with the surge? From what I understand, the COVID is surging again. But why does it always surge in the communist-controlled states? The deep blue states where it surges. Surge! Surging! Oh, my God, it surges. What can I say? I'm sorry. Sorry about that. You know, the surge, it catches one unawares. And what can I say? You know, guys like me, over 50, shot-free and COVID-free. For some strange reason, I never get sick.
So this is what we call extrapolating inaccurately from an anecdote. There are tens of millions of people who have not had COVID. And some of them are unvaccinated. And the fact that this caller didn't get COVID and isn't vaccinated tells us actually nothing about the pandemic.
That's so weird. It's almost like the pandemic doesn't exist.
And so that's what we call extrapolating too far. He didn't get sick, so it must all be imaginary.
Hey, we know that's crazy talk. You know, that's a conspiracy. Surge! 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 Sorry, Dave. That was a real surge. That was a real strong surge. Oh, my God. That was, I think I almost went blind with that one. Oh, my God. I just surged all over myself.
All right. So as you can see, these are not exactly the types of folks that you can really speak rationally with. That guy actually called into the show once about a year and a half ago, and his talking points were pretty similar. It's tough to get everybody on the same page about basic facts when you've got people who believe stuff like that. That's where we can leave it. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Won't even tell you what's on it. You'll just have to tune in to see. Get instant access to the bonus show by signing up at joinpacman.com. And you can use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to get a discount.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah. Bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You're seeing galaxies that are shining around other galaxies whose light has been bent. And you're seeing just a small little portion of the universe.
This week, NASA released the first images from its new flagship James Webb Space Telescope, revealing an unprecedented view of the cosmos.
So much of this is going to be just a treasure trove for astronomers when they're able to analyze the details of this picture. So I'm really excited about that, what we're going to learn from it.
Today, Science Friday of sorts, we'll look at the newest images from space with theoretical astrophysicist Katie Mack, the Stephen Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Canada. And we'll look at the controversy over naming the telescope after James Webb. He led NASA during the Apollo moon landings in the 60s, also played a key role in purging LGBTQ plus people from NASA, and before that, the State Department in what was known as the Lavender Scare.
There's no doubt that James Webb was a talented NASA administrator who advocated for the inclusion of science programs. But would Webb himself have wanted this telescope to be named after him when so many people were objecting?
We'll speak with astronomer Lucian Walkowitz with the Just Space Alliance, which just released the documentary Behind the Name, James Webb Space Telescope, that we'll feature today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden has met with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Earlier today, Biden traveled from Israel to the Palestinian Authority's presidential compound in Bethlehem. Along the way, his motorcade passed billboards and banners protesting U.S. support for Israel's occupation, as well as the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot dead by Israel's military last May next to the Jenin refugee camp. In a joint news conference with President Abbas, Biden claimed the U.S. continues to support a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He also defended the U.S. response to the killing of Abu Akleh.
She was an American citizen, and a proud Palestinian. I hope that her legacy will inspire more young people to carry on her work of reporting the truth and telling stories that are too often overlooked. The United States will continue to insist on a full and transparent accounting of her death and will continue to stand up for media freedom everywhere in the world.
Biden's remarks came after he rejected a request by Shireen Abu Akleh's family to meet with him during his visit to Israel. Abu Akleh's niece, Lina Abu Akleh, wrote, quote, "We would like Biden to do in Shireen's case what his and previous U.S. administrations have failed to do when other American citizens were killed by Israel. Hold the killers accountable," she said. Meanwhile, Biden's traveling today from Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport on a direct flight to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where he'll meet senior Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Press freedom groups are demanding Biden confront the prince over the killing and dismemberment of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. In 2018, the CIA concluded bin Salman personally ordered his assassination. The House of Representatives has approved $839 billion in new military spending for the coming fiscal year. The National Defense Authorization Act passed on a vote of 329 to 101, with the support of 180 Democrats. Lawmakers overwhelmingly voted down an amendment put forward by progressives that would have shaved $100 billion from the Pentagon budget. They also defeat an amendment to reverse an additional $37 billion piled onto President Biden's record budget request. Meanwhile, all 208 House Republicans voted against an amendment to the NDAA calling on the Pentagon and federal law enforcement agencies to combat white supremacist and neo-Nazi activity among government workers. Texas has sued the Biden administration over new federal rules ordering physicians and hospitals to provide abortions in cases of medical emergencies, even in states where the procedure is banned. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said in a statement the Biden administration seeking to, quote, transform every emergency room in the country into a walk-in abortion clinic, unquote. Meanwhile, in Indiana, the doctor who recently performed an abortion on a 10-year-old rape survivor is now under investigation. Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita announced the probe against Dr. Caitlin Bernard in an interview with Fox News' Jesse Waters Wednesday night.
We're gathering the information, we're gathering the evidence as we speak, and we're going to fight this to the end, including looking at our licensure.
Jesse Waters' Primetime was among the shows on Fox News casting doubt on the 10-year-old child's rape story. In response to the investigation, Dr. Caitlin Bernard tweeted, quote, "My heart breaks for all survivors of sexual assault and abuse. I am so sad that our country is failing them when they need us most. Doctors must be able to give people the medical care they need when and where they need it," she said. Abortion is still legal in Indiana up to 22 weeks into a pregnancy. The abortion performed on the 10-year-old girl was actually a medication abortion. She took several pills. Sri Lankan President Gotabaya Rajapaksa has resigned his post in a letter emailed from Singapore saying Parliament would meet on Saturday to select a new president. Rajapaksa fled Sri Lanka to the Maldives aboard a military jet early Wednesday amidst massive protests demanding his ouster. His resignation from exile sparked jubilation in the streets of the capital, Colombo, Thursday, where protesters continue to demand an end to corruption and nepotism they blame for Sri Lanka's economic collapse.
The whole country will celebrate today. It's a big victory. Actually, this Rajapaksa corrupted family, we never thought we will get this country free from them.
In Europe, a scorching heat wave fueled by the climate crisis has spawned massive wildfires from Portugal and Spain to France, Croatia, and beyond. Temperatures in Spain hit 115 degrees Fahrenheit this week, nearly breaking a record high set just last year. Much of China is experiencing record heat with triple-digit temperatures, affecting hundreds of millions of people. This comes after China recorded its hottest month of June in six decades. On Capitol Hill, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin told Democratic leaders Thursday he will not support legislation to combat the climate emergency or any tax increases on the wealthy and large corporations. It's the latest blow by Manchin against Joe Biden's legislative agenda and could spell the death knell for a watered-down version of the Build Back Better package in the Senate, where Democrats hold a razor-thin majority. The youth-led climate justice group, the Sunrise Movement, called Manchin's decision nothing short of a death sentence, and climate activist Bill McKibben tweeted in response, "Manchin has taken more money from the fossil fuel industry than anyone else in D.C., and the return on that investment has been enormous. Big oil got its money's worth 1,000 times over, McKibben tweeted. The International Monetary Fund is warning the global economy could soon slip into a recession. IMF Director Kristalina Georgieva said this week price shocks from Russia's war in Ukraine are making it harder for hundreds of millions of people to purchase food, fuel, and other necessities. China's Bureau of Statistics said today the economy grew by just 0.4% last quarter compared to a year earlier. That's China's lowest rate of growth since the COVID pandemic idled much of its economy in early 2020. In Brussels, the European Union has asked member states to curb their use of natural gas amidst fears that Russia might further reduce supplies. The EU says nations that increase their reliance on coal will be exempted from carbon emissions reduction goals. In Argentina, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Buenos Aires Thursday, angered by worsening poverty and unemployment. Protesters denounced the government of President Alberto Fernandez over its handling of debt with the International Monetary Fund that's hampered Argentina's economy.
50% of the population is below the poverty line, and the rates of severe poverty are increasing more and more. The inflation for food products is at 8%. They have just changed the Minister of Economy, and nothing has changed.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has agreed to spend $1.5 billion over the next 2 years to improve its border enforcement technology in joint efforts with the Biden administration to block asylum seekers from arriving in the United States. López Obrador made the announcement this week during a meeting at the White House with President Joe Biden, fulfilling demands first made by former President Trump, who said Mexico should pay for the border wall. In related news, three teenagers who were among the 53 asylum seekers who died inside an abandoned, sweltering truck in San Antonio, Texas, last month have been buried. Brothers Jair and Giovanni Valencia Olivares, ages 19 and 16, and their 16-year-old cousin, Misael Olivares, were laid to rest Thursday in the state of Veracruz. This is Jair and Giovanni's mother.
They wanted to build a house and start a business, not to spend their lives making shoes, because it is tiring work. There are jobs here, but they are very poorly paid. Things go up in price, but wages don't go up. That's why they went to look for a better life.
26 of the victims were from Mexico. And Mother Jones Magazine's published leaked audio of President Trump's former chief strategist telling his associates that Donald Trump had a plan to declare victory on election night 2020, even if he was losing. Steve Bannon made the remarks just 3 days before the election.
If Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it. I'm directing the attorney general to shut down all ballot places in all 50 states. It's going to be no. He's not going out easy. If Biden's winning, Trump is going to do some crazy shit.
Meanwhile, The Intercept reports the U.S. Secret Service erased text messages from January 5th and January 6th, 2021, around the time of the attack on the U.S. Capitol by a mob of Trump supporters seeking to overturn the election. A government watchdog with the Homeland Security Department said in a letter to lawmakers this week that the erasure took place shortly after oversight officials requested electronic communications from the Secret Service. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at the newest images from NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, as well as the controversy over naming the telescope after Webb, who led NASA ahead of the Apollo moon landings in the 60s and also played a key role in the Lavender Scare. That's the purging of LGBTQ plus people from the agency. Stay with us. Rocket Man by Sir Elton John. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, NASA released the first images from its new flagship James Webb Space Telescope, the JWST, revealing an unprecedented view of the cosmos, from galaxies that formed just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang to the births of stars and vast nebulas of gas and dust. The telescope is named after James Webb, who led NASA during the 60s in the run-up to the Apollo moon landings. Earlier this year, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson rejected a petition signed by over 1,200 astronomers and astrophysicists demanding a change to the telescope's name amidst new revelations about how Webb helped to purge NASA of LGBTQ plus workers as part of federal policy. We'll have more on that coming up. But first, we want to turn to the science coming from the JWST, which is already revolutionizing the fields of astronomy and cosmology. Dr. Katie Mack joins us. She's a theoretical astrophysicist and the Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Canada. She's author of The End of Everything, astrophysically speaking. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Katie Mack. These pictures have been spectacular, but so many of us don't know what we're looking at. So if in very lay terms, you can explain what was released this week.
Sure, yeah. So the pictures that were released this week are really some astonishing versions of the range of things that this telescope is able to do. So it got a deep field looking deep into the cosmos, the farthest reaches of the cosmos, very, very distant galaxies. It got a picture of interacting galaxies, galaxies that are crashing into each other, to show how this telescope is able to tease out the details of the gas and dust that stars forming. And it gave us images of a couple of nebulae, one where stars are forming, newborn stars are forming out of the gas and dust, and one where there's the remains of a dying star are sort of blowing up this bubble in space. And both of those are also spectacular pictures that we're going to learn a lot from when trying to understand the process of stellar death and stellar birth.
Can you explain how it is we have gotten these pictures, how the JWST is different from the Hubble Space Telescope, its predecessor?
Yeah, so it's a lot bigger, for one thing. The mirror is a lot bigger. So whereas the Hubble Space Telescope had a mirror of about 2.5 meters in diameter, this one has a mirror of something like 6.5 meters in diameter. So it's a much bigger mirror. So that means it collects more light, and it also sees in a different kind of light. So the Hubble Space Telescope would give us pictures in visible light and some infrared light. And this telescope, JWST, is all infrared. So it shows us light that's a longer wavelength than we can see with our eyes, but that allows us to see farther into the universe. And it allows us to see features of astronomical objects that you really can't see with ordinary light. So it allows you to kind of look through dust and gas to see the light, the stars forming inside these dust clouds. And it allows us to see some of the galaxies that are so far away that their light has taken billions of years to reach us. And that means that we can see galaxies that were forming in the very, very early universe. And that's also tremendously exciting.
Let's turn to the first full-color image returned by the telescope. And for a radio audience, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. But I know that Dr. Mack will be very descriptive in explaining. You have, on Monday, President Biden unveiling this unprecedented view of the cosmos known as a deep field image, as you've said, showing these thousands of galaxies, some 13 billion years old, formed a few hundred million years after the universe formed in the Big Bang. And if you can even explain the Big Bang, but as we see these images, describe that first picture.
Yeah, so the first picture, it's an image of a cluster of galaxies. So that's a bunch of galaxies that are gravitationally bound to each other. They're orbiting each other. So each of these galaxies is a collection of stars and gas and dust, you know, like our own Milky Way galaxy. And those are sort of swirling around each other in space. And then behind that cluster of galaxies, there's, you can see sort of the background of the distant galaxies far behind that. So there's the cluster of galaxies, and then all around it are these little colored dots and smudges that are very, very distant galaxies. So what's happening is, because we're looking so far into the distance, we're looking back in time, because light takes time to travel. And so the farther away we look, the farther back in time we're looking. And so we're looking at things that are so far away that they're almost at the time of the Big Bang. So the Big Bang was an event that happened in the early universe, the sort of start of the universe. We have really good reason to believe that the beginning of the universe was hot and dense and kind of full of plasma and sort of glowing with heat. And then over time, it expanded and that plasma cooled. And then there was a lot of hydrogen gas. And then that gas came together and started to form stars and galaxies and so on. And we're able to see some of the first galaxies that formed by looking at an image like this at really deep field, looking far, far into the distance. We can see some of those first galaxies. And it's even better because this image has a galaxy cluster in it. That galaxy cluster has so much mass, has so much matter, that it actually distorts the space that it's in. It bends the space that it's in. And that means that it distorts the images of some of those background galaxies. And so we can see these like arcs around the cluster in the center of the image. And those arcs are the distorted view of very distant galaxies that are behind the cluster. So we're actually seeing behind the cluster, and magnifying and distorting the images of these background galaxies. And that actually gives us an extra boost to be able to see even more distant things because of this magnification effect called gravitational lensing. So it's an amazing image with just so much in it, with all of these very distant galaxies. And astronomers are going to spend a long time analyzing each of those galaxies and learning about, you know, how those galaxies formed and sort of how this amazing diversity of galaxies that exist in the universe, how those came to be.
So another image from the new telescope shows the Southern Ring Nebula. Unlike the deep field image, which shows the most distant galaxies ever observed, this image is of something much closer to home inside our own Milky Way galaxy, still incredibly distant at like 2,000 light years from Earth. And again, this is a planetary nebula, that ring of gas and dust you described surrounding the core of a dying star that can no longer sustain nuclear fusion. Tell us what it teaches about the origin of our own solar system and the chemical elements that make us all up and everything around us, not to mention the fate of our sun.
Yeah, so this is an amazing image because it shows that kind of bubble that's produced when a star is dying, a star like our sun is dying, it sort of blows off layers of gas, it blows off its atmosphere in these layers and kind of creates this bubble of gas and dust around it. And that's what we see in this image. We actually see with this telescope, we're able to see that it's a double star system. One of the stars is dying and the other one is still kind of burning. And this telescope is so powerful that it's actually able to distinguish those two stars in the center. But it's a beautiful view of, as you say, the future of our sun, because our sun is a star that's going to blow off its outer layers, going to create a planetary nebula like this. It's called a planetary nebula. It's not anything to do with planets, but it's a historical thing that it's called that. And our sun, when it eventually dies, will sort of blow out these layers and sort of illuminate a sort of pocket of the universe. And so the nice thing about these images is because we have this infrared information, we have many different sort of frequencies of light we can look at. We can really examine what that gas is made of and learn about what the atmosphere of the star was when it blew out all those layers, and learn about sort of how it's been moving around and what that process was like as it was dying. So it's a really rich image.
And what about, well, one of the most beautiful of the first images of this new telescope has been dubbed Cosmic Cliffs. It's the Carina Nebula, gigantic cloud of gas and dust several thousand light years away our own Milky Way galaxy. The Hubble telescope making this nebula famous a generation ago. Now the new telescope imaging it with unprecedented clarity using the infrared part of the spectrum, showing it contains hundreds of previously hidden stars. Can you talk about this and our own sun born in a stellar nursery like the ones we're seeing in this image?
Yeah, this really is an amazing image. And it's one, I think, that has emotionally affected a lot of people because, yeah, you are seeing a stellar nursery. You're seeing these clouds of gas and dust where stars form. So I mentioned before that, the early universe was a bunch of hydrogen and then stars started to form. In the present day universe, stars also form in clouds of gas and dust. Things called nebulae. In this case, this is a star-forming nebula. And so you can see in this image, there's a sort of area of a bunch of gas with these sort of tendrils of gas and dust. And then above that in the picture is a kind of blue glow. And what's happening there is there are some really bright stars above that are kind of irradiating the gas below and kind of carving out these cliffs, these sort of features in that gas. And the amazing thing about what we see with the JWST is that we can actually see through that gas and dust and we can see the baby stars being born. And so we can actually essentially watch the formation of stars because we have so many stars in this picture. It's such a large image with so much in it. So many individual stars being born, so many little pockets of gas that we can kind of watch the progress of stars forming. And that, again, it really does tell us something about, you know, how our star formed in a, you know, cloud of gas and dust in the same kind of way. It might not have looked exactly like this, but it was the same kind of process where there was the cloud of gas and dust and it came together and gravity pulled it together and then it sort of ignited. And so we can watch that process by looking at this picture.
Dr. Mack, we just have 20 seconds before we go to our next guest, another astronomer. But I wanted to ask you, could this telescope show us the first scientific instrument to detect life elsewhere in the universe?
Well, that's a great question. We're not sure, but one of the things that it can do, and another thing that I didn't get a chance to talk about, is it can take the spectra of exoplanet atmospheres, meaning it can look at the gas in the atmospheres of planets around other stars, and there's a chance that it might find signatures consistent with life in the atmospheres of other stars. So we have to stay tuned. It's not entirely clear how well we'll be able to know what kind of gases life makes, but we can tell what the atmospheres of other planets might have in them. And we saw one example of an exoplanet atmosphere in this first release. So it's a very exciting prospect.
Well, Dr. Katie Mack, I want to thank you for being with us. Stephen Hawking, Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Canada, joining us from Waterloo there.
Thank you. This is
Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The release of the first images from NASA's new flagship James Webb Space Telescope this week revealed an unprecedented view of the cosmos. And at the same time, the news brought renewed attention to the controversy over the naming of the telescope after James Webb, who led NASA ahead of the Apollo moon landings in the 60s. He also played a key role in purging LGBTQ+ people from NASA and what was known as the Lavender Scare. And before that, at the State Department, while he was second in command there under President Truman. For more, we're joined by Lucianne Walkowitz, one of four astronomers who led a petition to rename the telescope. There are also the co-founder of the Just Space Alliance, which made a new documentary about the push to rename the telescope, which we're going to be featuring today. But in these first minutes before we play the part of this documentary, Lucianne Walkowitz, your response to the new images of space NASA released and why you made the film to push for renaming the JWST telescope.
Well, you know, I think the images are incredibly striking. They're absolutely beautiful, and they'll teach us so much about the universe. But I really wish that I could feel unreservedly excited about them. Unfortunately, the way that NASA has dug in its heels about naming the telescope after James Webb has really cast a pall over that for me personally, and I know for a lot of other queer astronomers as well. You know, I thought that this was one of the times to release this documentary, in part because I think we in the astronomy community have gone through a number of different methods to try and help NASA see sense on this issue. You know, I personally was a member of the Astrophysics Advisory Committee for NASA for many years until I resigned over this issue last fall. you know, as part of that committee, we requested that there be an investigation and a report, which has never been released. So, you know, I thought as part of Just Space and our producer and editor, Katrina Jackson, who pitched this idea to us, you know, we really thought that laying out the case with the available information about the historical record and also showing its continuation into how queer astronomers are treated now in astronomy was an important thing to do in conjunction with this release of these new images.
Well, Lucian Walkowitz, you're involved with this amazing documentary that we're about to preview, or at least a good chunk of it. Lucian Walkowitz, astronomer, co-founder of Just Space Alliance, who studies the ethics of space exploration, one of four astronomers who created a community petition that called on NASA to not name the telescope the James Webb Space Telescope, because they feel that he perpetuated homophobia at the State Department and NASA. Stay tuned in 20 seconds.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang. Screwed up eyes and screw down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung in snow white tan.
Ziggy Stardust by David Bowie. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're now going to turn to the documentary Just Space Alliance released this week called Behind the Name, James Webb Space Telescope. We're featuring most of it for you today.
Décollage, liftoff from a tropical rainforest to the edge of time itself.
Launched in December 2021, NASA's newest space observatory is set to open a new chapter in astronomy. Thousands of people across 14 countries worked together to get this massive, complex spacecraft assembled and placed 1.5 million kilometers from Earth, where its tennis court-sized sunshield cools the telescope enough for its 18 gold-plated mirror segments to reflect the faint glow of heat emanating from objects throughout the universe. These infrared wavelengths will reveal chemical signatures in the atmospheres of exoplanets, stars forming behind clouds of gas and dust, and the earliest galaxies from shortly after the Big Bang. It's an awe-inspiring mission, but does its name invoke the same spirit of scientific exploration and shared humanity as the telescope itself?
We are not waging a cold war.
After the Hubble Space Telescope, named for astronomer Edwin Hubble, NASA continued to name most of its space telescopes after scientists. Typically, these missions would start with a technical name and then get renamed around the time it was launched.
What I have heard as a rationale for that is, like, in case of a launch failure, families of often didn't want to be associated with their just failed space telescope. So often they renamed the telescope after the successful commissioning of a telescope.
5 months after the Gamma Ray Observatory launched in 1991, it was renamed after physicist Arthur Holly Compton. NASA renamed the X-ray Timing Explorer after astronomer Bruno Rossi 3 months after it launched in 1995. And in 1998, NASA announced a public contest to rename the Advanced X-ray Astrophysics Facility. The winning submission from a high school student was the Chandra X-ray Observatory, in honor of Indian-American Nobel laureate Subramanian Chandrasekhar. The Shuttle Infrared Telescope Facility was first renamed the Space Infrared Telescope Facility, and then after another public contest, was renamed the Spitzer Space Telescope 4 months after it launched in 2003. In 2008, there was a contest to rename the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope, which resulted in the observatory being renamed after physicist Enrico Fermi 2 months after launch. JWST took a different path. It was before construction even began that NASA announced the Next Generation Space Telescope would be renamed in honor of James E. Webb. Rather than going through any formal naming process, NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe decided on the name himself in 2002.
And in broad terms, our mandate is to pioneer the future, to push the envelope, to do what has never been done before.
This took many in the astronomy community by surprise. Partners on the project apparently weren't consulted, and scientists wondered, who? One good person to ask who is science historian Audra Wolfe, an expert on the role of science during the Cold War.
So James Webb, who's usually referred to as Jim Webb, is most famous for being the director of NASA during the Apollo years. He had previously been the Undersecretary of State under Truman. That's a second-in-command job at the State Department. He had also been director of the Bureau of the Budget. So he wasn't so much an engineer or any kind of space scientist, but a seasoned bureaucrat who knew a lot about the workings of government.
He is now bringing all of his remarkable skills of leadership and management to the service of our nation in this most urgent program in space. It is with particular pleasure that I present the Honorable James E. Webb.
NASA says they're honoring James Webb not just for his leadership during Apollo, but also for pushing to have a balanced program with a focus on science.
This is James Webb telling President John Kennedy the whole thrust of the agency is the lunar program. The rest of it can wait about 6 or 9 months. The people that are going to furnish the brainwork have got some doubts about it. President Kennedy responds, doubts about what with this program? Webb answers as to whether the actual landing on the moon is what you call the highest priority. President Kennedy says, what do you think? What do they think is the highest priority? And Webb responds, they think the highest priority is to understand the environment.
NASA launched more than 75 space science missions by the end of the 1960s. But if we are honoring Webb's leadership, it's worth taking a broader look at all the things that happened in government while Webb was in charge.
So at the State Department, Jim Webb really pioneered the idea that you could use science as a tool for foreign relations. And then separately, he also requested the study and implemented the findings of something called Project Troy, which really set the groundwork for the United States psychological warfare programs throughout the Cold War, with a really broad definition of psychological warfare as basically anything short of live bullets or economic warfare.
As a weapon of war, psychological warfare is no novelty. It is as old as war itself. But the use of this force as an integral part of combat has now taken on new forms.
And science was a part of that. The group had originally been formed to think about how to unjam Voice of America broadcasts, because the Soviet Union had been jamming their radio broadcasts. But this group really took a much broader interpretation of that mission, thinking about everything from how the United States could exploit Stalin's death to how you could use battles for prestige, say scientific prestige, to win hearts and minds around the world.
The space race and the Apollo program, of course, were also a big part of the Cold War.
The thing to understand about how Jim Webb saw the Apollo project is that on the one hand, yes, this was a scientific project. It was a technological spectacle. For Jim Webb, the point of the Apollo program was always to demonstrate the benefits of the so-called American way of life to the rest of the world, that the Apollo program was part of the Cold War contest to win the allegiance, particularly of leaders in newly independent countries, to convince them that the way that leaders did things in the United States and that the way that the government worked in the United States was preferable to that in the Soviet Union.
The Cold War was closely interwoven into many of the activities Webb was involved in at the State Department and NASA. Another major aspect of that was the systematic purging of suspected gay employees, known today as the Lavender Scare.
Two Republican congressmen claim Russia keeps a list of homosexuals in U.S. government jobs.
Four State Department employees resigned last year while under
investigation. Senator McCarthy testified today that a homosexual had been hired by the Central Intelligence Agency after the State Department allowed him to resign.
The department has considered homosexuals and other sex deviants to be a security risk.
It is the consequence of deed that lay the individual over to blackmail. He is ashamed. He is right.
State Department employees in South Korea have resigned after being accused of homosexual activity. State Department spokesman said the four weeks of them resigned. The law has notified them in evidence they committed a sexual act.
The Lavender Scare was closely tied to the Red Scare, a frenzy drummed up by Senator Joseph McCarthy and others that communists were hiding in the U.S. government. In February 1950, McCarthy claimed that over 200 communists were working for the State Department.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
During Webb's February 13th staff meeting, they discussed vigorously defending the quality of the department's security against McCarthy's accusations. And in an effort to do so, later that day, Deputy Undersecretary John Purifoy told the Congressional Committee that the State Department had already been actively working to remove security threats from their employment roster. None of them were communists, but of the 202 people they had fired over the previous 2 years, 91 were suspected to be homosexuals. As stated in historian David Johnson's book on the Lavender Scare, rather than see the revelation as evidence of an effective security system, many interpreted it as proof that the State Department, perhaps the entire government, was infiltrated with sexual perverts. Senator Clyde Huey was tasked with investigating the situation. Huey told his chief counsel,
"I don't want any public hearings at all on this matter. I want it as low-key as possible. Do it thoroughly, investigate it from hell to breakfast, but we're not going to have any hearings that McCarthy can make big headlines out of."
Senator Huey asked Jim Webb how his committee could work together with the executive branch on the investigation. On June 22nd, during one of Webb's regular meetings with President Truman, they discussed Senator Huey's request.
"I informed the president that Senator Huey had wished me to find out how his committee and the executive branch could work together on the homosexual investigation, and he advised me to say to the senator that he was sure we could find a proper basis for cooperation. He approved a suggestion that Mr. Murphy, Mr. Spingarn, and I see Senator Huey on Saturday to discuss the necessary problems involving this cooperation. James E. Webb."
To prepare for the meeting with Senator Huey, the Assistant Secretary of State for Administration, Carlisle Humelzien, sent James Webb a package of information on June 24th. This included suggestions on how the Senate committee should conduct its investigation and how the State Department should work with him, as well as a background paper on the problem of homosexuals and sex perverts in the Department of State. This was quite literally a state-sponsored manifesto of homophobia, describing homosexuals as emotionally unstable and abhorrent and repugnant to the mores of American society. But it also gives a lot of background information. As the document mentions, the government had no rules against the employment of homosexuals, and it wasn't until just recently that anyone really considered it a problem. In 1947, Humelzien's predecessor John Purifoy took it upon himself to start ordering really intrusive investigations into the State Department's employees to seek out possible homosexuals. By 1950, there were two full-time security staff members devoted to these investigations, which involved inquiries at all places of employment, all residences and habitats. They tried to determine if any friends or associates were homosexual, and placed employees under surveillance to determine if they were visiting any known homosexual places. Suspected employees were interrogated by the investigator and the chief of the Division of Departmental Personnel or Foreign Service Personnel. If they came to the conclusion that the employee was homosexual, they were promptly fired. And again, at the time, there was no actual rule against homosexuals being employed in the government. Humelzien's stated argument for firing them, in addition to thinking they were repugnant, was that
most homosexuals are weak, unstable, and fickle people who fear detection and who are therefore susceptible to the wanton designs of others.
So the State Department considered homosexuals a security risk. And according to Executive Order 9835, signed by President Truman in 1947, agencies were responsible for ensuring that disloyal employees were not retained. In the very next paragraph, though, Humelzien admits that
We have no evidence, however, that these designs of others have caused a breach of security of the department.
In fact, throughout the Lavender Scare, no one ever had evidence of a U.S. government employee being blackmailed into giving a foreign power state secrets due to their sexual orientation. But that did not stop the State Department from devoting considerable resources to subjecting its employees to surveillance of the most personal aspects of their lives. Equipped with this information, Jim Webb met with Senator Huey on June 28th, along with Stephen Spingarn and Charles Murphy, two of President Truman's advisors. According to Spingarn's account of the meeting, Webb gave the senator that paper Himmelstein wrote, the manifesto of the State Department's homophobic viewpoints and justifications for firing homosexual employees. They discussed whether any part of the Senate hearing should be public. Huey and Spingarn said they thought maybe the medical testimony should be public and the rest in executive session, but Jim Webb wasn't sure, and they all agreed they would think about it some more. As far as we know from easily accessible information, that was the extent of Webb's direct involvement with the Senate hearings. According to the suggested process written up by Carlisle Himmelstein, Himmelstein himself would serve as the department's spokesperson on the Senate investigation, while Webb and Secretary Dean Acheson would be kept informed of all significant developments and should be available for behind-the-scenes activities when necessary. With a generally homophobic society, most members of the public and Congress were all too ready to believe the sorts of positions touted in Himmelstein's memo to Jim Webb. The majority of other government agencies also agreed, but not all of them. For example, the acting director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service told the committee,
"Since it is possible, according to our understanding of medical and psychiatric opinion on the subject, for a homosexual to lead a normal, well-adjusted life, we do not consider that such a person necessarily constitutes a bad security risk."
After the Senate subcommittee's investigation, their report stated that homosexuals should be fired for two reasons. First, they are generally unsuitable, and second, they constitute security risks. The State Department's actions and the Senate subcommittee's report caused the practice of tracking down and firing suspected homosexual employees to spread widely across the federal government and initiated decades of homophobic policies. President Eisenhower signed Executive Order 10450 in 1953, which explicitly added sexual perversion as a reason for an individual being unsuitable for government employment. By the time Jim Webb became NASA administrator in 1961, some of the media and congressional attention to the Lavender Scare had died down, but many agencies were still regularly targeting queer employees. On October 22, 1963, NASA budget analyst Clifford Norton was driving his car near Lafayette Square. Two police officers from the Moral Squad saw Norton pick up a man, drive around the block, and drop him off in the same spot, at which point the man drove off in a separate car. The officers followed both men to Norton's apartment building, where they arrested the two of them in the parking lot and took them to the Moral's office to issue a traffic violation for speeding. The police interrogated both men for 2 hours about their activities and sexual histories. Meanwhile, the head of the Moral Squad called over the NASA security chief, who arrived at 3 a.m. and watched the last part of the police interrogation as Norton continued to deny the homosexual accusations. Then the security chief brought Clifford Norton over to NASA headquarters, where he and a colleague interrogated Norton until 6 a.m. Through these hours of late-night interrogation, Norton conceded that he sometimes experienced homosexual desires when drinking, but continued to deny he was a homosexual. After the interrogations, Clifford Norton's supervisor said he believed Norton was a competent employee doing very good work, and he asked personnel officers whether there was any way to avoid firing Norton, because he didn't think this was a real security problem to worry about. The personnel officers told the supervisor that it was custom within the agency to fire anyone involved in homosexual conduct. So, Norton was fired due to possessing traits of character and personality that render him unsuitable for further government employment. Custom within the agency implies that NASA fired others as well. There isn't any easily accessible information on how many suspected homosexual people NASA interrogated and fired during Jim Webb's administration. The only reason we know about Clifford Norton is because he fought back. Norton called up Frank Kameny, who at that point was known for advocating for government employees who were dismissed over their sexuality. In fact, Frank Kameny was an astronomer who the American Astronomical Society has celebrated for his leadership in the gay rights movement.
He got started because he was trained at Harvard by Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin to be an astronomer. He went and he worked for the U.S. Army with his astronomy degree, and he was fired. And he was so outraged by that that he turned it into a lifelong pursuit of activism of getting these laws changed.
This is at a time when people in my profession were in higher demand than they had been in all of human history. And I could not get a job specifically because of homosexuality. And I am not alone. I know many people who have done the same. I've seen careers ruined, lives destroyed for no other reason. These were people with a great deal to offer to society, simply because society is prejudiced against them and will not allow them equality of opportunity.
He coined the term gay is good. And therefore said, like, if it's good and if it's an inherited good thing for us to be out, then it cannot be a security risk, because that was always the argument.
Frank Kameny helped gather facts on the case and referred Clifford Norton to an attorney with the ACLU. After a prolonged legal battle, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in 1969 that federal employees could not be fired solely on the grounds of being homosexual. Homosexuality would justify dismissal only if it demonstrably affected the employee's performance on the job. NASA's Clifford Norton case and efforts from activists like astronomer Frank Kameny slowly turned the tide on institutional homophobia. But government discrimination against queer people continued for years.
Should someone be able to serve their country if they say they are homosexual?
The State Department in 2017 made a partial public apology for the Lavender Scare, but NASA and other agencies have never apologized for their participation. And as far as we know, no effort was ever made to compensate the victims or their family members. In 2002, when Administrator Sean O'Keefe renamed the Next Generation Space Telescope after James Webb, a lot of this information was not widely known. And though astronomers were confused by the unilateral decision to name the telescope after a former administrator, many were just happy the project had high-level support and funding. But in the mid-2010s, a few started to raise questions about what Webb's role was during the Lavender Scare.
So I think it must have been around 2015 or so, when I was still on the executive committee for Psi Sigma. That's the Committee on the Status of Sexual Orientation and Gender Minorities in Astronomy. I was a founding member of the committee, and a blog entry came our way that raised questions about James Webb's participation in the Lavender Scare. And there was some discussion about, you know, how we as a committee should respond to that. And then essentially the attitude from particularly from the more senior members was the ship has sailed on that, and there wasn't really anything that we can do about it. And at that point, I kind of dropped it as a thing that I could change, but decided it was something that I could at least talk openly about.
In early 2021, four astronomers launched a petition to change the name of the telescope.
Chanda Prescott-Weinstein, Sarah Tuttle, Brian Nord, and myself decided that prior to the telescope's launch, we would create a petition that would essentially allow the astronomical community to coalesce around having this change of name.
Hence the start of the petition and an attempt to kind of bring this to more astronomers and just say, hey, is this a thing we want to touch base about before this telescope gets launched and we start collecting data with it? You know, let's sort of check in and see what's going on here.
It was really heartening to see that over 1,800 people signed the petition. These are folks from as early career as in high school to major senior PIs, people inside and outside academia, including 10% of the signatories are people who have applied for JWST time. So people who are getting ready to use the instrument, people who are excited for the science are included in those people who signed the petition.
Meanwhile, internally, NASA started an informal investigation into James Webb's role in the Lavender Scare, led by the JWST program scientist and the NASA historian. They were having trouble accessing records because the National Archives and the Truman Library were closed to researchers due to COVID. But after a few months, they got a contract set up for an independent historian to do research once the archives opened up. In the meantime, the independent historian started reading through some more readily accessible materials and came across the Clifford Norton case. The historian noted that a custom within the agency sounds pretty bad, and NASA, under the direction of Webb, was able to set its own rules for whom should be removed and for what reasons. Members of both the Astrophysics Advisory Committee and the American Astronomical Society's Committee for Sexual Orientation and Gender Minorities asked NASA for updates on the investigation and information on NASA's process for reconsidering the name. For the most part, NASA leadership gave those committees the same information that they were giving to reporters and the public. NASA was aware of the concerns, and they were working with historians to examine Webb's role in government. Over the summer, one of the interns in the history department also started looking into information on James Webb, and in early September wrote a lengthy email full of information and sources. They wrote that Webb played a leadership position in the Lavender Scare is undeniable. The only thing left up to historical debate in this matter is whether or not his heart was in it. Was Webb emotionally invested in the persecution of LGBTQ people? Either way, one thing is clear, he still did those things. And those things served a key role in a bigger thing, a thing that, as NARA archivist Judith Atkins has pointed out, led many to suicide. The NASA historian said that there was a lot of good information in the intern's write-up that he would include in his final report. Meanwhile, the independent historian still had not been able to access the archives, which were set to open in October. But on September 27th, a one-sentence statement from NASA Administrator Bill Nelson was sent to six reporters. "We have found no evidence at this time that warrants changing the name of the James Webb Space Telescope. There is no report released and no details on the investigation, and a lot of people were upset about NASA's lack of transparency. Many astronomers feel that changing the name of the telescope would be a way for NASA to start to reckon with its past and help reinforce the values NASA wants to carry into the future."
I think it would help send the message that NASA in its current era does not tolerate the same sort of intolerance that was present in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We are going to do our best to foster an inclusive, accepting, and welcoming environment, that we want people who have been historically discriminated against and persecuted, because they make our agency stronger.
And for astronomers who are using the telescope, applying for time, you know, writing up their work, knowing that they're kind of reinvigorating the legacy of somebody who very clearly did not support them, I think it's a particularly heavy burden to ask queer astronomers to have to carry that burden. It kind of sends a pretty clear message about who is considered important or relevant.
You know, this isn't James Webb on trial. This is, what should we name the telescope? And I don't think anyone starting from a clean sheet, looking at lists of names and coming up with the best name would have James Webb anywhere near the top of that list.
You know, I realize that people's legacies are often complicated, but, you know, having a telescope named after you is not something that everybody just gets.
To be honest, I'm not quite sure why in this particular case NASA is so insistent on James Webb. It feels a little bit strange. There are just so many choices for NAN, right? Even if James Webb was a great guy, if this NAN is not, it didn't get buy-in from the community, I don't see a strong reason that we need to stick to this specific NAN.
One suggestion for a different name for the observatory could be the Harriet Tubman Space Telescope.
So I think that when we're talking about sending something that represents humanity into space, that we should be thinking about sending the best of humanity into space and something that represents our very best. And Harriet Tubman is an exemplar of who we can be as a species and as individuals in terms of a commitment to what is right and doing what is right, a commitment to justice and a commitment to being actively engaged in struggle and to liberation.
The criticisms that I've sometimes heard are, you know, like, oh, well, Harriet Tubman wasn't an astronomer. Well, neither was James Webb. And also, you know, I think the question of who is an astronomer, right? Like, let's think about, why wasn't Harriet Tubman an astronomer, even though she observed the night sky and used the stars for celestial navigation in the service of something that could not have been greater, right? People's freedom. You know, to me, like, that makes her an astronomer.
With the name, I just see a lot more hope and happiness. There's a lot more positive characteristics that come with a name such as Harriet Tubman Space Telescope than comes with James Webb, I'd say. And it gives a lot of people who have traditionally been excluded in the community a lot of a sensible longing, I'd say.
An extended excerpt from the new Just Space Alliance documentary called Behind the Name, James Webb Space Telescope. We'll link to the full film on our website. It's produced, edited, and narrated by Katrina Jackson, a space science communicator and video producer. The film features the historian Audra Wolf, NASA's Rolf Danner, astronomers Chanda Prescott-Weinstein and Lucian Walkowitz, who we spoke with earlier about the petition they helped launch for NASA to change the James Webb Space Telescope's name, which has gathered 1,800 signatures and counting. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman.
Reach the eye.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Millionaire, pot of thieves. Wild cord on my sleeve. Thick heart of stone. My sins my own. They belong to me. Me. People say beware, but I don't care. The words are just rules and regulations.
Here she comes, coming through my door.
stadium with 20,000.